Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And we're going to begin today with relations between the United States and Ukraine after that three-way bust-up in the Oval Office last week between Volodymyr Zelensky and Donald Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance. In the wake of the row, the US said it was suspending military aid to Kyiv. Well, today it was confirmed that President Trump also ordered a pause in the intelligence that the US shares with Ukraine. Here's the CIA Director John Ratcliffe speaking to Fox News a little earlier.
What President Trump said is he asked for a pause. President Trump is the peace president. Never been a war under his leadership. He wants to end the wars that exist. And so in this case, as everyone saw play out, President Trump had a real question about whether President Zelensky was committed to the peace process. And he said, let's pause. I want to give you a chance to think about that. And you saw the response that President Zelensky put out a statement saying, I'm ready for peace. And I want Donald Trump's leadership to bring about that peace. And so I think on the military front and the intelligence front, the pause that allowed that to happen, I think, will go away. And I think we'll work shoulder to shoulder with Ukraine, as we have, to push back on the aggression that's there.
But before it goes away, what might be the impact on Ukraine's military? And what exactly is the intelligence that's shared? Matthew Saville is Director of Military Sciences at the Royal United Services Institute, the security think tank in London.
I should add a note of caution before I begin, which is that in many cases we don't know the full details of the intelligence sharing relationship, which is probably the right thing if you're Ukrainian. But the way that the US system has talked about it, it's a broad spread from tactical intelligence used to help directly on the battlefield, longer range intelligence used to help identify threats coming in from Russia, so to give them advance warning of air attacks. And then somewhere in there, there is intelligence and information that the Ukrainians use for targeting probably into Russia. And the US has talked about its imagery sharing. I should also add that the Ukrainian intelligence system, which was already very capable, has probably been improving significantly over the past couple of years and able to do some of this itself.
Presumably, though, the US intelligence that you've described, much of it is what? Provided by satellites that Ukraine doesn't have?
It'll be a range of some very good access that could be provided by very sensitive sources. And then, yes, large quantities of satellite imagery. The Ukrainians themselves have been developing excellent use of various data sifting tools and commercial imagery for several years now. But it might be that some of the really specialist intelligence can only come from the US. I think some of what we should be talking about in terms of the impact is less on the day-to-day and here and now, particularly if this gets switched back on, and more on the question of trust and what it tells us about what the US is prepared to do to get to peace talks.
Just before we get to that, can I just ask you how big an impact do you think this will have on Ukraine's military, which we know is already struggling to hold off Russia's advances? I mean, could it be significant, even if it is only temporary?
It depends on what exceptions there are. So if there are exceptions for being defensive, i.e. incoming fire, then it will be enormously unhelpful for Ukraine's efforts to attack Russia and inflict damage on it. But it might not affect their ability to defend against air attack and on the ground. If there is essentially a blanket cutting of that intelligence, then the Ukrainians will be essentially relying purely on their own sources. And as I say, while some of that is good, there is always a question of quantity helping out in intelligence, which is that you can only point your collection assets, be that a person who's spying or equipment collecting communications, at so many targets at once.
Just thinking about the peace talks, because this is part of pressure to bring Ukraine to the table. I mean, given that we haven't seen or don't know about the sort of pressure that the US is exerting on Russia, if at all, I mean, what does it say about trust? If you're Ukrainian, can you see the US as an even-handed broker in all this?
Well, I think the fact that the US is attempting to talk about itself as neutral, President Trump was explicit about this the other day, that is in and of itself a major loss for the Ukrainians. I mean, I think it kind of stretches credulity given the US has been the single biggest backer of Ukraine. But that is a net loss for them. And in terms of trust, I think the fact that they are prepared to use everything from weapons deliveries to intelligence sharing to basically coerce and almost extort the Ukrainians, I think that will be devastating for trust.
And one brief final question. What about the Five Eyes intelligence sharing partnership between the US, the UK, also Canada, Australia and New Zealand? Does this move undermine that in any way, do you think?
I don't know if this directly undermines that. If other members of the Five Eyes are sharing intelligence and that came from the US in the first place, then that intelligence will also be affected by the bloc. I think the bigger question is one of, again, trust in the US. Five Eyes is a much longer standing, extremely well-tested intelligence relationship. But I think the other members of the alliance would be kidding themselves if they thought they didn't need to at least be looking at what is it that they share with the US, under what conditions, and how secure are they in their reciprocal arrangements? Because I think if you are now looking at essentially a purely transactional relationship, the fact is the US puts a lot into Five Eyes, and it might start attempting to, if you like, quantify the value of that relationship.
That was Matthew Saville of the Royal United Services Institute, the security think tank. Even though Donald Trump's only been in office for 6 weeks or so, challenges to some of his executive orders are already making their way up to the US Supreme Court. One of these concerns an order by the administration that nearly $2 billion in payments to foreign aid organisations should be withheld, money dispersed by the government for work already carried out. Well, today America's top court decided to reject that order, upholding a ruling by a lower federal judge. Barbara McQuaid is professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School and a former United States attorney. What was the court's reasoning?
The Supreme Court upheld a lower court's ruling that said that these funds were authorized by Congress and the funds have already been spent on businesses and non-government organizations that provide relief work all over the world. And so these debts are due to them based on this congressional appropriation. And so for the Trump administration to halt these payments would cause, in the view of the judge, irreparable harm to these groups. And so essentially, they are preserving the status quo by requiring the government to pay its bills.
But this is only about money for work that's already been done, not any future payments. Is that right?
That's right. And, you know, to understand what USAID is, it's the United States Agency on International Development. That's an agency created by Congress, the legislative branch, to provide relief work all over the world with the idea that it helps lift up the United States soft power. That's a congressional decision. And so the president, under the U.S. Constitution and the separation of powers, can't eliminate that on his own. The president certainly is supposed to take care that the laws be faithfully executed and make disbursements consistent with that mandate from Congress, and could pause payments if people aren't performing the work, for example. But here, the work has already been done. And so stopping these payments is really just failing to pay the bills of the United States. Certainly, there is an appeals process, and this won't be the end of things. This is just this temporary restraining order designed to preserve the status quo for now. And the future of USAID is something that can be debated. If Congress wants to vote to eliminate the USAID, they could do that. But the president on his own cannot eliminate it. That's up to Congress.
And at the same time, you have Elon Musk, an unelected official, talking about the tyranny of the judiciary. And I guess for many people in the United States, you know, they might see comments like one of the dissenters to the ruling, Samuel Alito, saying, you know, look, one judge can't stand in front of the federal government and think, well, yeah, that's right. That judge is unelected. Why should they stand up to the federal government? The federal government should take priority.
Yes, we've been seeing a constant barrage from Elon Musk and other allies of President Trump going after judges who are stopping some of these orders. So far, there's been quite a bit of success from plaintiffs in challenging some of President Trump's early executive orders and complaints saying these judges are overreaching or they should be impeached or other kinds of things. But that is the role of our judiciary. They're not elected on purpose. They are appointed and serve life tenure so that they can be insulated from the political process and decide cases, even if they might be unpopular, based on our constitutional separation of powers. And so I find it alarming that we see people speaking out. Certainly you can disagree with the judge's opinion, but to say that therefore they should be impeached or other things, that is how the court system works.
And on that issue of agreement and disagreement, I mean, the split of the court's decision was 5-4, with two of the conservative justices siding with the three liberal judges. What do you make of that?
I think that's very encouraging that justices are going to be deciding these cases based on the facts and the law and the Constitution and not any sort of perceived political allegiance. I think the Chief Justice, John Roberts, and Justice Amy Coney Barrett here lining up with the three justices who have considered themselves more progressive may end up being sort of the bulwark against presidential overreach. Certainly the president is entitled to a great deal of administrative power. But at the end of the day, he must only be one of three co-equal branches of government. And so I find it gratifying and a little bit of a relief to see that these two justices will stand up for what I see as the rule of law. And so we may find ourselves in a number of these 5-4 splits. But as long as we have five justices who will put the Constitution ahead of any political gamesmanship, that to me is a good sign going forward.
But not, as you've made clear, this isn't a precedent. This is about one particular case. What's likely to be the next case that they have to decide when it comes to these issues of presidential power and possibly presidential overreach?
I think we're going to see a number of them. So most of these cases are at this stage, what's called a temporary restraining order, where a judge has issued a temporary pause just to maintain the status quo while we go forward. I think eventually many of them will reach the court. I think one of the ones that people have their eyes on most is the president's executive order eliminating birthright citizenship. So our Constitution provides that people born in the United States are citizens of the United States. Donald Trump has issued an executive order saying that's not true, and that anybody whose parents were not documented citizens in this country who are born here will no longer receive birthright citizenship, and they should not receive passports and other vital documents. That one is on pause, but I think we'll certainly see that one come before the court. The firing of federal employees without giving them their due process rights is also something that will percolate its way to the court. And I think within the next year, we are going to see whether this Supreme Court is going to hold the line and protect the role of Congress or allow the president to exert a very muscular sort of executive power that we've not seen before in this country.
Professor Barbara McQuaid there. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. Still to come on the programme, ahead of May's presidential election rerun, we'll hear from supporters of the populist right in Romania.
We're not fascists here. We're just normal people wanting to be able to choose our leader and exhausted with the ones that are in power now.
More from Romania in 25 minutes. Our main headlines from the newsroom this hour. US officials have confirmed President Trump on Monday ordered a halt to intelligence sharing with Ukraine, as well as the suspension of military aid. And the White House says that it's been holding direct talks with Hamas over hostages held in Gaza. We'll be getting a few more details on that from Jerusalem in half an hour. This is James Menendez with NewsHour Live from the BBC. It's now pretty well known that aspirin can help prevent heart attacks and strokes in some patients. Well, now it seems that this humble painkiller may also stop some cancers from spreading. There was already some evidence this was the case, but a new study published in the journal Nature has revealed how it works. Rahul Roy Chowdhury led the research. He's Professor of Cancer Immunology at the University of Cambridge.
Metastasis, or cancer spreading, is of course the process which brings this localized disease. Cancer starts in one place of one tissue in the body, and it can spread and disseminate cancer cells to various other parts of the body. And we know that cancer spread can occur quite early during cancer development. And this process of metastasis is, of course, the cause of 90% of cancer deaths.
So you want to try and stop that process?
Yes. And so it was with the intention to understand whether these dormant micrometastatic deposits are sensitive to the immune system that we chanced upon. And I must say, it was rather serendipitous, really, that we chanced upon this mechanism by which aspirin releases the immune system from restraint and can thereby attack these cancer deposits.
Tell us about the serendipity. Why was it surprising? Were you looking for something else, or you just didn't expect that the aspirin would have this impact?
So just to give you this context, so over the last decade, it's become apparent when really studying patients who were taking either aspirin or a placebo drug in large clinical studies that were done really to test whether aspirin could prevent heart attacks and strokes. And we know that it can in some cases. In those studies, people noticed that when people got cancer, that the chances of that cancer spreading was reduced by about 30 to 40% if those patients happened to be on aspirin. But the mechanisms behind how aspirin might be exerting this broad effect across potentially multiple cancers, colorectal cancer, prostate cancer, and potentially breast cancer, for instance, were not clear. And many studies had focused on the anti-inflammatory activity of aspirin. But as we know, aspirin also has this clot-busting activity. So we were, as I was mentioning earlier, studying the process of metastasis using mouse preclinical models and trying to understand how T cells recognize those metastatic deposits and whether anything was restricting their function, stopping them killing those metastases. And we learned that a clotting factor released normally by platelets was a potent immunoregulatory or restrictive factor for T cell immunity against metastasis. And by giving animals aspirin, we learned that we could release T cells from this suppressive factor and thereby enable them to go out and kill those micrometastatic deposits.
Right. Just to be clear, it's those T cells that are part of the immune system that can that can help those cancer cells from spreading around the body. So this was in mice. So does that mean we need now some human trials before this starts to be rolled out at some point in the future for humans?
Very much so. So I mentioned that there is evidence that aspirin can prevent metastasis in people with cancer. What is now needed is better quality evidence from prospective randomized controlled studies. And so there is a large prospective randomized controlled study now going on. And so we will learn of the results of this study within the next couple of years.
Professor Rahul Roy-Chowdhury from the University of Cambridge. Now, basketball, because the sport's biggest name, LeBron James of the LA Lakers, has staked another claim to be the greatest of all time. Last night, in a match against the New Orleans Pelicans, he broke an NBA record. So the first player to accumulate more than 50,000 points in his career. Let's break it down. He's been a player for 22 years, 82 games in a season, an average score of around 28 points in a game, 9 baskets at 3 points or 14 at 2 in every game. So how big an achievement is this? Well, Gary Washburn is a basketball writer for the Boston Globe.
Well, it's just kind of a testament to the greatness of LeBron James and his longevity. This is 50,000 points, regular season and playoffs combined. He already has the record for most points combined in a regular season. So this is just another milestone, another record. He has set a handful of great records, all-time great records, and this just adds to his legend, his longevity, and his perseverance as one of the great athletes of all time.
Yes, longevity. How do you explain that? I mean, he has had such a long career, 22 years. He is now 40 years old. How's he managed it?
Well, he spends $1 million a year on body maintenance. I think he lives well. He eats well. He's just meticulous about his conditioning and about his body, you know, care. A lot of times when athletes get into their mid-30s, you know, the weight gain comes and their metabolism slows. And he has fought that process by just keeping himself in immaculate shape. And so at this point, he has lost athleticism. He is not the athlete, pure athlete he was 10 and obviously especially 15 years ago. No one is the same at 40 as they were at 25.
Absolutely.
He is a smarter player and a player who knows how to when to give his 100% and when to at times probably give himself a breather here and there and preserve himself. And that's an art form, and he's mastered that.
Is he a smart player also in the sense he's intelligent on court? Does that help him compensate for, you know, a slight lack of athleticism over the years?
Oh, yeah, he's a master. He has extremely high basketball IQ. It's like playing with a master of karate or a master of, you know, dance or whatever skill you may think of. He is the top of that chain. He is the master. So he is knowing, he knows where players are supposed to be before they even know. He tells players where they need to go, what they need to do. So it's like having a coach on the floor. And obviously, when you're a student of the game like he is, and he has mastered it, it makes up for some of the athleticism that he's lost. So he becomes a better player because he's a smarter player.
We're all human. How long do you think he's got left?
Well, you know, no one has really pushed this envelope as much in terms of playing basketball. Tom Brady played till he was 45 in the NFL, National Football League, American football. There's been players who have played in the NBA till they're 42, 43, but they didn't play as much. They were kind of at the end of the bench. You know, they were role players playing at a high level. I think he's got 2 or 3 years left without question. Now, does he want to continue to try to approach his mid-40s and set records and you know, maybe slow down a little bit and maybe have his role lessened, or does he want to go out on top as still one of the greatest players and not kind of reduce himself to that? So that's the question, because he's definitely can play 2 to 3 more years at this level, but eventually it's going to happen where he's going to hit that wall and he could probably still continue to play, but not as many minutes. So it all depends.
Gary Washburn, who writes about basketball for the Boston Globe. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us. We've got lots more coming up in the second half of the programme. Welcome back to NewsHour. As Israel and Hamas continue to argue over the next phase of the Gaza ceasefire, another deal is bearing some fruit, at least. It's an agreement between Jordan and Israel to treat about 2,000 seriously ill children from Gaza. On Tuesday, the first group of 29 arrived in the capital, Amman, after a journey by land and air organised by Jordan together with the World Health Organization. The BBC's Fergal Keane watched them arrive.
A child with a child in her arms. Shada Abu Dhaka, 17 years old, is feeding her 6-month-old sister, Naveen. The baby looks more like a newborn. She struggles to absorb nutrition. She has a hole in her heart. You're sad because you're leaving us and going, Shada tells the infant. Naveen is being evacuated to Jordan for treatment, which isn't available in Gaza. Mothers are having to make heart-wrenching choices. Naveen's mum, Inas, has 6 children, but 4 must stay behind.
I did hope to take them all with me, not only the sick one and her sister. I'm not happy I'm leaving my children behind. I left my soul behind me. They are all my children.
Everybody is wrapped up well for the journey. The windows of the buses taking them away are misted from the warmth of the bodies on board. A little boy presses his palms against the glass. Outside, a father waves repeatedly. The 29 children and their guardians were allowed to travel by bus, ambulance and helicopter after first being cleared by Israel. The evacuation was organised by Jordan, whose King Abdullah announced it during a meeting with President Trump in Washington last month. Here at Marka Air Base on the outskirts of Amman, I can see two helicopters approaching. They're the first of a wave coming out of Gaza today with injured and sick children from the war. Right beside me, there are ambulances lined up to take them to hospitals here in Amman. It's the first phase of a complex operation that's been planned for months. First to emerge, blinking into the sunlight, was 11-year-old Abdulrahman al-Nashash. He walked with crutches. His left leg was amputated when he was caught in Israeli shelling. His mum Asma explained that her husband was killed in an airstrike. In Jordan, though, there was hope for her boy.
I want to have my son treated. I want him to walk as he did before. We want a ceasefire. I worry about my children who are still there. I was crying all the way here. I'm scared for them.
What we saw emerging from the helicopters were wounded, seriously ill children. Nearly all of them had left close family behind. Still, the sight of the Jordanian rescue aircraft in the bright sun, the smiles on several young faces, felt like that rarest of things in this war, a hopeful interlude.
And that was the BBC's Fergal Keane reporting there from Amman in Jordan. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. It was pitched as a State of the Union address, even if it couldn't be this early on in the presidency. And in fact, it didn't really talk about future plans either. Instead, President Trump's address to Congress last night was a greatest hits playlist, even though he's only been in office for a month and a half.
6 weeks ago, I stood beneath the dome of this Capitol and proclaimed the dawn of the golden age of America. From that moment on, it has been nothing but swift and unrelenting action to usher in the greatest and most successful era in the history of our country. We have accomplished more in 43 days than most administrations accomplished in 4 years or 8 years, and we are just getting started.
The president didn't have it all his own way, despite a rapturous reception throughout from his Republican Party. There was heckling from the Democrats, and at one point one of their congressmen, Al Green, was thrown out of the chamber.
Mr. Green, take your seat. Take your seat, sir. Take your seat. Finding that members continue to engage in willful and concerted disruption of proper decorum, the chair now directs the sergeant-at-arms to restore order. Remove this gentleman from the chamber.
Well, let's hear more about the response and whether Democrats have a plan for opposing Donald Trump. We're going to hear from Jimmy Panetta, one of the party's representatives in California. First of all, what did he make of the speech?
Watching it, experiencing it, it was a little brutal all the way around. And I sort of feel like I have a hangover today, to be honest with you. Obviously, and I'm not just talking about the length, I'm talking about the substance, and that it was just very disappointing, very discouraging, and obviously depressing, considering how deceptive and how distorted and dishonest and ultimately dishonorable that the president was when it came to certain issues that he spoke about. You have a president who continues to mischaracterize and manufacture numbers for his own good and his own promotion, rather than talking through serious policies or facts. But, you know, I think we understand that about this president. That is where he's at. It's our job just to continue to go forward, obviously try to find areas that we can work with him on. But most importantly, it's going to be fighting back and continuing to push back on this guy.
And just thinking about when you hear things that you either disagree with or you know not to be true, I mean, what is the best way to respond? Is it by heckling in the chamber? Is it by holding up placards?
Well, look, I think what you got to realize is that there's a lot of frustration. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of anger. People really just don't know what to do. So, you know, I understand that some of my colleagues are expressing themselves in different ways. Welcome to the Democratic Party. We're trying to ensure that we represent the best interest of our constituents, and people do that differently in our very diverse Democratic Party.
Do you agree with them, though, the way they did respond to it? I mean, it's, some have said it was a little bit childish. Do you agree with that?
Oh, look, there are certain actions and reactions that I don't do, but that's the way they do it in their own personality. But it's more about their districts, I would hope. They're there to represent the people of their congressional districts, and they're going to do it in the way that they feel is appropriate, which I completely understand, and that because that's exactly how I do it. And when I uphold decorum, when I ensure that I show up, step up, and speak up when it comes to pushing back and fighting back on this administration.
How should the Democratic caucus in Congress channel that frustration that you talk about? Because, I mean, the reality is that as a caucus, I mean, there's not much you can do at the moment, is there?
Yeah, look, I mean, we are in the minority, and it's a very tough position to be in. I've been in it before, and not just the minority in Congress, minority in Senate, and there's a Republican in the White House. So they have the trifecta. We understand that. That being said, we have to continue to ensure that the American people and constituents in Republican districts actually understand whether or not their member of Congress is either agreeing with Donald Trump or agreeing with their districts. And that's the question that constituents need to hold and propose to their member of Congress. Are you loyal to Trump or are you loyal to me? Because I can tell you, there are Republican constituencies that use Medicaid. And if they go forward with this reconciliation package that offers and puts forward extreme cuts to critical programs like Medicaid, like food programs, like student loans, that's going to be an issue where those representatives need to be held accountable.
And is that going to be the party's strategy, or should that be the party's strategy in the 2 years before the midterm elections, to go after the Republicans on those bread and butter issues, things like welfare payments and, of course, the economy?
We're more than happy to negotiate and work with our Republican colleagues. We're here to get stuff done. And a good way you do it is through negotiations and ultimately compromise. That's what it needs to be about here in the United States Congress. However, if they're not willing to do that and they put forward destructive policies that actually affect and hurt working families, then you're right. We're not only going to push back from our congressional districts, but they need to understand that their constituents are going to push back, Democrats and Republicans, on any sort of destructive policies that hurt their constituencies.
The Democratic strategist James Carville has written a piece this week saying that the best strategy for the Democrats going forward is to do nothing and watch the Republicans implode. Do you agree with that?
I agree to a certain extent that the Republicans are going to overreach. They can't help themselves. And I believe that based on some of the policies that they put forward, especially with this budget resolution, you're going to see them overreach and make drastic cuts. We're seeing it with the fact that they have Elon Musk leading them down the road of cutting these agencies, cutting these bureaucracies, taking a sledgehammer and a chainsaw to them. The issue is that's when government seizes up. That's when people don't get the services they deserve, like Social Security and Medicaid and Medicare and veterans benefits. And that's what's going to happen going forward. So you're going to see overreach if they continue with these destructive policies and fail to negotiate with Democrats.
It can't just, though, be a we're not Donald Trump or his Republican Party message. Does the Democratic Party need to formulate a positive message in the month? I mean, I'm talking sort of medium to long term here. And I just wonder what that message is.
Look, our message is that we have shared values and that we're basically, and there are places in America where you can still work hard, play by the rules, and have opportunity. And that means that we got to focus on middle-class working families. We got to ensure that we have a strong national security and a strong, secure southern border. And we have to make sure that people understand that democracy is messy, it's tough, but you know what? It's best when people come together, step up, and step forward, as we're seeing in our districts. Look, this president has remade the Republican Party. This president has remade the presidency, unfortunately, but he cannot remake our democracy because he cannot rewrite our Constitution, and we're going to make sure that we uphold that.
That was Jimmy Panetta, Democratic congressman from California. Donald Trump's election win has strengthened the hand of far-right parties across Europe, and Romania is no exception. Both Vice President J.D. Vance and Elon Musk have criticised the decision by Romania's Constitutional Court to cancel the results of last November's first-round presidential election. That was won by a relative unknown, Calin Georgescu, a radical anti-globalist with Russian sympathies. The court said Russian interference and campaign funding fraud had skewed the result. It'll now be rerun in early May. But will Mr. Georgescu be allowed to take part? From Bucharest, Nick Thorpe reports.
A sea of Romanian flags in central Bucharest. Last Saturday, tens of thousands of Romanians marched through their capital in support of Calin Georgescu, a 62-year-old agricultural engineer who says he wants to put Romania first.
I asked Dragos, a Romanian living in Canada, what he's protesting against.
They want to keep Romania under the globalism. They want the war. They want to kill the people. We are nothing for them. We are just meat. We can die. They gonna be richer and richer.
Many in the crowd blame the war in Ukraine not on Russia, but on what they see as a global elite. They accuse the current Romanian government of being a puppet of that elite, while their critics portray their hero, Calin Georgescu, as a puppet of the Russians.
We want freedom of choosing and the democracy.
Freedom, freedom! So you want Mr. Georgescu to win the election?
Yes, yes, and he will.
Lavinia is marching with her husband, Sherban, and their three-year-old daughter, watching it all wide-eyed from her pushchair, astonished by the commotion all around her. Back in December, Romania came under US pressure from the outgoing Biden administration, as well as its NATO allies in Europe, to prevent Calin Georgescu's victory. Now the Trump administration is pressuring Romania to let him run. Their response was dramatic. In a series of raids across the country, police discovered gold bullion, cash, and an arsenal of weapons. They belonged to Horatiu Potra, a former soldier in the French Foreign Legion who backs Calin Georgescu in the May election.
They're quite serious allegations, conspiring against the constitutional order, membership of a neo-fascist organization, anti-Semitism. You don't believe this?
No.
Georgescu has been photographed with Potra, who also ran militias in Africa. And Potra made no secret of his support for Georgescu, though it's not clear what prosecutors will be able to prove in court. But the charges against him may be cited to disqualify him from standing in the May election. Oana Efdemie, vice president of the Patriotic People's Party, another nationalist grouping, defends Georgescu.
We are not fascists here. We are just normal people wanting to be able to choose our leader and exhausted with the ones that are in power now.
For a different angle, I spoke to Elena Calistru, president of Funky Citizens, a liberal non-governmental organization.
What we're saying is that if you have a house and the roof is leaking, you don't burn the house, you fix the roof, right? Unfortunately for us, though, the malaise that we see all over Europe, the lack of leadership, the lack of politicians that are capable of talking to the general public without trying to compete with the populists is also present in Romania.
While right-wingers in the West oppose immigration, Romanian nationalists are often immigrants themselves, working in Western Europe, dreaming of ending their servitude to the rich world. In Romania, those in power now face a dilemma. If Georgescu runs and wins, it would undermine their image as a stable EU and NATO member. If they ban him, it will reinforce the righteous anger of the street, and their claim that democracy is only permitted if it serves the interests of the rich and powerful.
And that was Nick Thorpe reporting there from Romania. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. Well, within the past couple of hours, the US has confirmed it's been holding direct talks with Hamas over the hostages held in Gaza. Paul Adams, our diplomatic correspondent who's in Jerusalem, has been telling me more.
Not a huge amount, James, except that the White House has confirmed that its special envoy, Adam Bola, has indeed had negotiations with Hamas. According to the White House spokeswoman, Carolyn Leavitt, the special envoy who's engaged in those negotiations, in her words, does have the authority to talk to Hamas. Obviously, this is a group considered to be a terrorist organization with whom the American administration, successive American administrations, has not had any contact, although it's believed the Biden administration may have had one meeting in April last year. A senior Hamas official has told the BBC that two direct meetings took place between Hamas and a US official, presumably Adam Bola, in Qatar, preceded by several communications. This is all about trying to secure the release of one living American hostage, a 20-year-old soldier, Edan Alexander, and four others who are believed to be dead. The negotiations do not appear to have resulted in anything so far, though one or two Israeli networks are saying that what the Americans are doing is offering to pressure Israel into negotiations on phase two of the ceasefire deal as some kind of incentive to Hamas. And as you know, those negotiations are deadlocked right now.
Did Israel know about these contacts between the US and Hamas?
It's not quite clear whether Israel was told after the fact or before. Israeli officials are saying that they are aware of these contacts. The Prime Minister's office released a statement, an hour or so ago. It is pretty terse, I have to say. It says simply the following: Israel has expressed to the United States its position regarding direct talks with Hamas. I think you can take it from the brevity of that statement that Israel is not best pleased about this. The idea that anyone would be going behind Israel's back to secure the release of individual hostages might be seen as undermining Israel's overall position when it comes to trying to move forward.
Paul Adams in Jerusalem. The National Gallery's new exhibition of early 14th century religious paintings from the Italian city of Siena has already been a sensation at the Metropolitan Museum in New York. It's a co-curation between the two galleries, bringing together priceless works of Sienese art for the first time in 700 years. The exhibition argues that Siena has been unjustly overshadowed by its Tuscan neighbour Florence in the history of art, and that it's actually in Siena where painting really emerged as the preeminent art form. The colours are astonishing, the gold shining out on every wall. Laura Llewellyn's one of the curators of the exhibition in London, and she's been speaking to my colleague Rebecca Kesby.
Siena at this date and in the century before is a real hotspot. It holds a pivotal position on the Via Francigena, which is the major thoroughfare, the pilgrimage route which connects Canterbury to Rome. And it's not just bringing pilgrims in and out of the city, but also tradespeople and, crucially, objects. So it's this amazing kind of furnace, in a way, for visual encounters. Siena's also really plugged into the Silk Road because of the access it has to the ports in southern Tuscany. So you have these extraordinary connections east to west as well.
And in terms of what the pictures look like, the style coming from Siena at this time, how would you describe it?
Many of the pictures have a kind of dominant presence of gold. One of the things that I think is so mesmerizing about the gold in this exhibition is the way in which artists are so adept at manipulating it. They are real masters in the art of tooling and punching and scraping and scratching in order to create the most dazzling surface effects on the gold.
So this collection, you've brought together works that have never been seen together, well, certainly not for hundreds of years, and you're really trying to shine a light on this period of art, which, I mean, many people are saying has been overshadowed, rather, by Siena's neighbour and rival, Florence.
Yes, you know, we're not trying to suggest that nothing was happening in Florence and it was all happening in Siena. Of course we're not. You know, even as we speak, there's an exhibition going on at the Louvre exploring Cimabue, for example. But what we're trying to do really is complicate the story and make a case before how incredibly important Siena was to the development of a Western tradition of painting that is really in a kind of state of germination at this point. And that's really because the painters working in Siena at this date were pushing the boundaries of what a painting could do, so thinking about painting as something that could tell a story or something that could express emotion or something that could even give a sense of space on a two-dimensional surface. So all ideas that we begin to associate later on with what a painting can do are being formulated and explored at this point in time.
And what is the great advantage of seeing all these works together in a collection, not just sort of seeing them one at a time or individual moments?
I think works of art from this period especially, which have migrated over the course of their lives into collections and onto gallery walls, have often been divorced from their original context. So particularly early paintings from the 14th century were very rarely intended to be pinned onto a wall. They were often either to stand on an altar or on a smaller scale, perhaps to be held in the hand. And so in a way, we are kind of reinstating the nature of these works as objects. And by bringing them back together, we're able to get much closer to the artist's creative powers, essentially, in formulating these objects and not thinking about them as individual scenes that we pop in a frame and put on the wall, but instead thinking about them as sequences and works which really speak from one to the next. And, you know, one will propel the other forward, as it were.
And for those that aren't in London, can't see this exhibition easily, is there anything online that the art gallery is putting forward for people who might be interested?
Absolutely. There will be a video coming shortly and various, you know, opportunities to engage with the exhibition through digital means and through social media. We also have a catalogue that was published by the National Gallery, and there was a shared endeavour between the Metropolitan Museum of Art, our partner in this project, and we hope a real legacy for the study of this period.
And that was Laura Llewellyn, one of the curators of that exhibition about early Renaissance art in Siena that's at the National Gallery in London. She was talking there to NewsHour's Rebecca Kesby. And that brings us to the end of this edition of the programme. From me and the rest of the team here in London, thanks so much for listening. Until the next time, bye-bye.